Hey there, it's Annie Baxter, and this is Writing Minnesota. In the next hour, you're going to hear something out of the ordinary. It's literature that helps us understand the Minnesota we live in today. We've got a radio adaptation of a short story by one of the state's most nationally celebrated authors, poems that take us to the whispering shores of the Mississippi and the grain fields of Red Wing, and lots more. Along the way, we're going to look at what it means to be a Minnesota writer. Is that label good or bad? How does a writer's work relate to the place they call home? Of course, there are people who've studied such things, and for the most part, they say Minnesota writers have a lot in common with their fellow Midwestern writers. They're focused on small-town life and nature, and they don't like snobs.
Midwestern experience tends to be realistic and true to life. It tends to reject pretense, and it tends to root for the common people.
Philip Griesley is the editor of a tome called The Dictionary of Midwestern Literature. It catalogs about 400 Midwestern authors who have some common obsessions. They write about the America of unlocked doors and traditional values.
It's not the elite. It's not the cultural hubs. It's a reflection of a common experience and simple life.
Griesley says it's not too hard to find examples of Minnesota writers who fit this mold. You could probably name at least one on your own.
It's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown, out on the edge of the prairie.
But you know, some writers don't want to be branded with this regional label. Some say their writing just doesn't address the local landscape and culture, and others don't like the suggestion that their work speaks only to small regional truths. They want the universal truths of their work to resonate. Poet Steve Healy once struggled with this problem.
I think I used to be afraid of being too local, of sounding provincial. I think a lot of writers have this fear, unless you live in New York City, which you never feel local if you're in New York City. But I got over that.
Healy's latest poetry book is titled 10 Mississippi. It includes 10 different musings on the Great American River, whose headwaters are in Minnesota. He read one of the poems on its banks.
Standing next to the river, I recorded the sound of the river in an attempt to represent that sound more accurately than my earlier description of it, which compared the river sound to someone saying, shh. I rewound the tape and played it back, and the recording also sounded like someone saying, shh, but then I remembered that I was listening to both the recording of the river and the river itself, and I could not with absolute certainty distinguish one from the other. It sounded like the two sounds synchronized into one shh, but at times they seemed to separate, as if telling each other to be quiet, like accomplices committing a crime. Or they may have both been telling me to be quiet, despite the fact that I was producing no sound, or so I thought. Retreating swiftly and quietly to the privacy of my own home, a safe distance from the river itself, I listened again to the recording of the river sound. This time it sounded like a perfectly preserved memory of the river, a solitary shh moving inexorably toward the Gulf of Mexico. And just as I felt liberated from the burden of having to remember the river through my own mental activity, the recording stopped, precisely at that moment when I had turned off the tape recorder. Then I remembered that the river itself was elsewhere, continuing its perfect sound forever, and that I would never be able to represent that continuousness accurately. I remembered, however, that I could take a length of magnetic tape on which that river was recorded and splice the ends together to form a loop that I could then play continuously. The sound could keep going, shh, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, telling all the cars and condos to be quiet. It's worth remembering, however, that a river is not a person, and that a person saying shh eventually needs to stop making that sound, either to inhale or die. There would be no other choice, unless, of course, I recorded myself saying shh and played a loop of that recording continuously, in which case I'd no longer need to remember myself. I'd be immortal in the privacy of my own sound.
That's poet Steve Healy in Minneapolis. He's the author of two books of poetry. You're listening to Writing Minnesota. I'm Annie Baxter. You know, the face of the state has changed a lot in the past few decades. We've had the decline of the agricultural economy and a big influx of immigrant groups. And a couple of recent memoirs from surprisingly young authors have done a really nice job of documenting those shifts in the culture. My colleague Jackie Fuller and I recently met up at a coffee shop to compare notes on these two books. Jackie's a writer herself, and she told me about Cao Kalia Yan's book, The Late Homecomer, a Hmong family memoir.
It's partly her story and partly the story of her family. The first half of the book, she's not even born yet. It's the story of how her parents met when they were in Laos, and they were essentially refugees living in the jungle. They escaped from Laos to a Thai refugee camp, and that's where Cao Kalia Yan was born. And then they moved to Minnesota.
She was a little kid when she came here?
She was a little one when she came here.
How was her book received in the Hmong community? Did people feel like it was an accurate representation of their story?
I think from reading the book, she was not only happy to take on that role of being a spokesperson for a generation of people, but it was her intention. She felt that her family had stories and that she says, I'm their best bet of getting these stories on the page.
My mom said, that's the story I would write if I could. And every time I meet somebody who's my mom and dad's age in the community, they come up to me and they say, we're so proud of you, our daughter, for telling our story. What I've grown to understand is that they've carried the misunderstanding for far too long because they didn't have the fluency to tell the stories.
So how important is the landscape of Minnesota to her?
When she writes about Minnesota and about growing up in St. Paul, it's very stark. It's flatness and identical brown housing projects and mold growing on a wall in a Section 8 house. It's maybe not the Minnesota that a lot of us are familiar with. It's portrayed in this very stark contrast to her parents' stories of Laos, of the homeland that's lush and beautiful and the mountains. And you get the sense that she had some difficulty making Minnesota home.
And was that true from a language perspective? Did she grow up in an English-speaking household?
She did not. And at 6 years old, she became a selective mute.
What does that mean?
Well, it can mean not talking or it can mean whispering, but you choose to just sort of not speak. Around this same time, she was shopping with her mom in Kmart, and her mother couldn't find the word for light bulbs.
She was looking for the thing that made the world shiny. And the clerk walked away, and my mother stood there looking at her feet. And I decided that if the world didn't need to hear my mom and dad, then surely it didn't need to hear me. So I stopped talking the next day. And time passed, and the words got rusty, and when I tried to speak, kids laughed. So I stopped completely. But I was a kid, and the words had to go somewhere, so they went onto the page.
She grew on the page, and then she had a teacher that cultivated that in her, and that really became her voice. And she won 2 Minnesota Book Awards for The Late Homecomer.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and people sort of treated her a little bit differently after that.
People started saying, this is Cao Kalia Yan, the Minnesota author, award-winning. You know, it was an overnight transformation in the way I was received.
And for someone who has documented so much struggle in making Minnesota home, she considers Minnesota home, and she considers herself a Minnesota writer.
Okay.
So who did you pick, Annie?
I picked a book by Nicole Helgett. It's called The Summer of Ordinary Ways. And it's about her life growing up on a farm in southern Minnesota. She currently lives in Mankato, kind of in the neighborhood of where she grew up. And it's a really beautifully written book. But I also got pulled in because the book was just so different from what I was expecting.
How so?
Well, I knew that it was about farm life, and I guess I expected this kind of bucolic setting, you know, but it is dark, dark, dark. She's documenting abusive relationships between her parents, alcoholism, and in particular, there's this one really tough scene that happens pretty early in the book, and her father is essentially, like, beating a cow to death. And her writing renders the scene so beautifully and delicately, but it's just this horrible image. She's describing the sound of her dad's pitchfork against the cow's nose.
It was the sound of girls splitting wishbones, of mom dividing chicken breasts, and of shovels crushing black rats breeding in the granary. It was the sound of field stones hitting the loader bucket or hay wagon or rock box. It was the sound of a cottonwood tree lifted from the lawn, twisted, and sailed into the drying bin by a tornado. The sound of the collision and explosion of wood and metal, and the rush of millions of soybean grains winding in a golden vein, breaking through the gape and flying off into a gray heaven. It was the sound of Adam's rib breaking to build Eve.
Wow, that was intense.
Yeah, I know. You know, she makes a joke that the Minnesota Tourism Board is not going to offer a job anytime soon, you know. But, you know, on the other hand, how lucky to have her here, because she is writing this incredibly gorgeous prose.
So, other than the darkness, wasn't there some other controversy around this book?
Yes. In fact, some of her relatives and even neighbors waged this campaign against her when the book was coming out in 2005. They contested some of the facts of the book.
Really?
Among them, this brutal scene with her father beating the cow to death. And they said, you know, this just didn't actually happen. And so, I mean, this, you know, raises all sorts of questions. And I talked to Nicole Helgett about them. You know, first of all, how true is her own account of her life? But then also, how true of a representation of Minnesota life and culture is this?
I think it accurately represents both. You know, I believe that there are some of those folksy types of households out there. But I also think there are households like the one that I wrote about. I know that there are. And I've gotten lots of letters from girls who were, you know, raised in a similar situation, and from even old women who have grown up on the farm and who the story really resonated with. So I know that it's not just me. I think it's a widespread story.
That just seems like every writer's nightmare, that you write a memoir and you're family comes after you and contests it, you know.
Horrible experience probably. Although she's made amends. She says she's made amends with these family members, and they're on better terms now. But she wants people to appreciate the literariness of her writing and not get hung up on those questions of, well, did she actually tell the truth or not? You know, she thinks that it's a work of art. She's also really interested in people paying attention to her representation of farm life in the 1980s.
When you used to drive through southern Minnesota, you would see Holsteins in the fields. You would see farmers out walking their beans, and you would see their wives hanging clothes. To a great extent, those things don't exist anymore because of deregulation in the 80s. These farms are gone. The men who used to tend this land have now gone to work in the factories or have become truck drivers. A lot of them are very sad. A lot of them are lost. And I wanted to capture that.
And she's actually quite wistful in remembering that era. You know, she's about 35 now, and she says not many people her age or have a parent who actually used to go and milk a cow by hand. It's all mechanized, and it's a very different way of life, and she wants people to pay attention to that part of her book.
That seems a little bit young to write a memoir, or some would say. And one of Kalkalia Young's peers also said, you're too young to write a memoir.
Yeah, it seems like it's a very common criticism to level against a young writer. The idea is, right, you need to have more experience.
Yeah.
But it does seem like both of these writers, you know, they come from families that just have such complicated experiences and tales to tell that, you know, why not put it down on the page, I
guess.
They
felt the need to tell them.
Yeah.
So can we swap books? Because I really want to read this.
All right, I'll give you my copy if you give me yours.
Okay.
Jackie Fuller is a producer at Minnesota Public Radio and a writer. The book we were just talking about by Nicole Helgett juxtaposes a pastoral setting with really tragic events. That's also true of this next poem.
My name is Robert Hedin, and the name of the poem is The Wreck of the Great Northern. Where the Great Northern plunged in, the river boiled with light, and we all stood in the tall grass, staring at a tangle of track, and four orange coaches, and one Pullman lying under the current, turning the current clear. We stood staring as though it had been there all along, and was suddenly thrust up out of the weeds that night as a blessing, as a long, sleek hallway dropping off into fields we'd never seen, into the pastures of some great god who sent back our steers, too heavy to move, all bloated and with green seaweed strung down their horns. And we all looked down into the lit cars at businessmen and wives already back to breathing water, and saw in the cold, clear tanks of the Pullman a small child the size of my son, a porter's white jacket, a nylon floating gracefully as an eel. What the train and the river were saying, no one could understand. We just stood there, breathing what was left of the night. How still the cars were, how sleek, shimmering through the undertow, and I saw the trees around us blossomed out, The wind had come back and was blowing through the tall, empty grass, through the high grain fields. The wind was rattling the dry husks of corn.
That's poet Robert Hedin in Red Wing. He's the author of 23 books of poetry and prose. You're listening to a special program from Minnesota Public Radio News called Writing Minnesota. I'm Annie Baxter. Now, the writers you're hearing in this show are some of my all-time favorites, in Minnesota or anywhere for that matter. And that includes our next featured writer, Charles Baxter, to whom I am not related. Baxter's a major player on the national literary stage. He's got 5 short story collections and 4 novels, one of which was turned into a movie. Baxter's a Minnesota native, and much of his fiction is set in the Midwest. He says he's sometimes baffled by critics' reactions to that. He recalls at least one irksome literary review.
The review began, although Charles Baxter's characters are from the Midwest, they are nevertheless quite varied and interesting. And I thought, that's the pigeonhole that I'm going to be put into.
It sounds like you've resigned yourself to this label to some extent, even though you don't like this idea of being pigeonholed?
I have written stories that take place in Venice. I've written several stories that take place in New York City. And my novel, The Soul Thief, takes place in Buffalo and Los Angeles. Every time any one of these pieces come out, I'm described as a Midwestern writer all over again. Hmm. It's just what happens. But I think any writer is finally influenced by the places where he or she grew up, the kind of people that the writer has known and lived with. And when you close your eyes and you think of your imagination's home, it has to look like something.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it looks like Minnesota. My grandparents lived here. My parents lived here. The ghosts of my family are all here. I grew up here, and I became familiar with this landscape and grew to love it.
So would you put yourself in any kind of continuum of other Minnesota writers? Do you think there is something like a regional voice, in other words, in which you would play a part?
Minnesota writers, I'm not so sure. Midwestern writers, probably. Sherwood Anderson and others who have written about lives in small to medium-sized towns, lives that are isolated in one way or another. And in my stories, there's a kind of range of characters, many of whom are living semi-secret lives, which is what I think Midwesterners often do. They don't give up their autobiographies all that easily. You have to pry it out of them. We're not like Southerners that way.
Mm. So they have these kind of darker secrets lurking that aren't going to come out as forcefully at
right,
first.
Right, okay. Right. And it's interesting because we're in the age of the internet, of the web.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says that region doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
But it's not true.
Hmm.
It's not true. It's one of the first things that anybody thinks about. You don't say, oh, he's from anywhere and everywhere.
Hmm.
People don't say that. Well, I guess they do, but it's not very helpful. I believe that location is destiny. Once I didn't think so, and now I do.
Author Charles Baxter. Coming up, we'll hear a radio adaptation of his short story, The Winner. It takes us to the north shore of Lake Superior, where the old Midwestern disdain for snobbery takes a peculiar turn. That's in a minute on Writing Minnesota. From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Annie Baxter, and this is Writing Minnesota. In this program, we're talking to some of the great writers living in the state and hearing their work. It's time now for our main attraction. It's a short story by author Charles Baxter. Again, no relation. Charlie, could you set this up?
The story concerns a freelance journalist named Jerry Krumholtz, who has been assigned by Success Magazine to interview Success Magazine's monthly winner, who this particular month is James Millard. And unfortunately, it's not a good match because Jerry Krumholz has a sort of low-level distrust, even dislike, of the very rich. And the story concerns what happens to him when he arrives at Millard's house and meets the various people who live there.
Now here's a radio adaptation of Charles Baxter's The Winner. It's from his new collection, Griffin, New and Selected Stories.
In the hills bordering Lake Superior's northern shore, Krumholz was lost. Behind the wheel, searching for a landmark, he hadn't seen a road sign or any other indication of a human presence for miles. Ahead of him, the road began another series of indecisive twists and turns, heading into a forest so dense that a desolate canopy of branches blocked the sky and shielded the road from the sun. He felt as if he were drifting into a tunnel of vegetation where the usual norms had been reversed. Here the trees were permanent, but the route was temporary and subject to disappearance. At almost exactly the moment when Krumholz thought he should turn the car around and head back, he came upon a long expanse of hurricane fencing with razor wire at its top. He saw a driveway on the right-hand side and a high gated barrier with the word Millardhof carved in wood at the top. An intercom with a white button stood in front of the gate. Krumholz drove up in front of it and pressed the button.
Yes?
It's Jerry Krumholz.
He waited. The silence continued for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, almost half a minute.
From Success Magazine, I have an appointment with James Millard.
From the forest came an in-sucking breath of wind.
This interview was set up a long time ago.
You don't have to plead. Do you believe in angels?
Excuse me?
It's a simple question.
Well, it may be simple, but I don't know.
You don't know if you believe in angels?
Just then, the gate lifted as if on invisible wires, and Krumholz drove in. He had the impression that video surveillance cameras were trained on him as his car made its way up a switchback dirt road around the bowl of a valley to the crest of the bluff. Krumholz didn't feel like getting out of his rental car, but when he saw a woman emerging from the front door, he thought he'd better get to work.
Hello, hello, hello.
She smiled with what must have been forced cheer, but the smile was so dazzling, Krumholz thought for a moment she might actually be happy to see him. She wore beige capri pants and a simple gray blouse, and she looked, as the wives of the rich often did, like a professional beauty.
Mr. Krumholz, I'm Ellie Millard.
Jerry, please call me Jerry.
I shall call you Mr. Krumholz, for the sake of your dignity.
Her skin, which at first he had assumed to be deeply tanned, he now saw had a permanent, attractive darkness to it.
Please come in. You must be tired out.
Well, I got lost.
Everyone does. But anyway, here you are now. And welcome to Millardhof.
Very impressive.
He was looking down the front hallway into the depths of the house. The corridor disappeared in the distance as if replicating the geometry of infinity.
My goodness.
Goodness had nothing to do with it.
She was quoting Mae West.
But it is rather stupendous, I'll grant you that.
The diamond on her finger was the size of a grape.
So, how many square feet is this house anyway?
He felt her hand on his back as she guided him down the front hallway toward a living room, which he imagined to be the first of many.
No idea. Quite a few, but we've never counted them up. Would you like a drink? Something to eat?
No, thank you. I'm quite all right.
From invisible speakers came the sound of music, Bach or Handel, Baroque something, performed on the original instruments, court music, yes, the water music, that was it. On the wall, two side-by-side flat-panel video screens showed a man's face contorting in agony, relaxing, smiling, then contorting in agony again. Hung next to it was another screen showing a woman who appeared to be shouting soundlessly for help.
What's that?
Oh, that diptych. That's an installation by Herb Furcht, the video artist. He's a wonderful guy. Do you know him? He's become such a good friend. It's called Agony Number 6. It's a poor title. I begged Herb to change it, but I do love his work. And after all, Herb's a thoughtful guy, even with his irony, and he has the right to name his pieces because he's the artist. But you know, there never was an Agony Number 5. Isn't that odd? Or maybe it was the wrong kind of agony.
I should really start my interview with Mr. Millard.
Well, I could be mistaken, but I think Jimmy's in the tub. Earlier today, he was outside making furniture, and I think he probably worked up quite a sweat.
Had she really just touched him on the cheek with the tips of her fingers? Why would she do such a thing?
Why don't I show you around the house first?
The interior walls consisted of poured concrete, and now, when she touched part of the wall, a section of it gave way under her hand. It was actually a door, invisibly hinged.
Why did you ask me about angels?
Excuse me?
When I was in the car at the gate, before you buzzed me in, you asked me whether I believe in angels?
I did. No, I don't think so. Why would I do that? I didn't buzz you in. It might have been Lorraine. Lorraine is the other woman.
She turned and gazed at him again.
Do you believe in angels?
No.
Well, neither do I. But I used to.
They proceeded down the hallway toward an open doorway. When he turned the corner, he found himself in what appeared to be a master bathroom placed in the middle of the hallway with a large whirlpool bath built into the floor. Leaning back in the bathtub with his eyes fixed on Krumholtz was the February winner, James Millard.
Ah, so at last you're here. We thought you must have been a little lost being late. As you were, what happened to you?
Yes, I'm sorry, I got lost. I was misdirected.
Millard stood up and stepped out of the whirlpool bath. He was quite magnificent, still in possession of a sculpted athlete's body, classically muscled and proportioned.
We wondered what had gone wrong with you.
Without a trace of shyness and still wet, Millard stepped toward Krumholtz and shook his hand hard. He had a strong, wet grip with large, thick fingers. Having finished the handshake, Millard stepped backward toward a grooved section of wall where he pressed a recessed button. Hot air came blowing out on him from louvers in the wall, drying his body as he pivoted, his arms slightly up. Krumholtz glanced over at Millard's wife, who was gazing appreciatively at her husband. Like the gods, these people had no timidity or shame.
Well, how should we conduct this interview, this little interview?
Perhaps in your den. I have a digital recorder.
Wouldn't you rather be doing something? Something physical? Do you hunt? It's deer season. We could go hunting. Actually, no. Unfortunately for us, the light's going. It's too late in the day. We could go out tomorrow, if you wish.
Well, no, I don't hunt.
Here I am, Krumholtz thought, talking to this naked man while his wife looks on.
We could chop some wood. There's time. We could do that.
But you've just washed, and I have to take notes.
You mean there's a rule? I didn't know there was a rule.
He walked into the bedroom on the other side of the bathroom and put on the worn clothes he had apparently just taken off.
There's never a rule. That's the first thing you have to learn. Come on.
Is this your hobby, splitting wood?
Not a hobby. No, hobbies are for others. It's an activity, a physical exertion that we like. A few minutes and then you can take over.
Wherever Millard turned, he gave off an air of command. The velvet glove over the iron fist had grown very thin with him. He split logs with efficiency, Krumholtz thought, but also as if he were in a permanent rage.
So, you have questions? Ask questions, ask me questions.
Why did you move out here? It's a bit remote.
We didn't want to see any neighbors, so we bought up the entire valley. You can look in any direction, you won't see anybody. It gives you a freedom, you know?
Yes, well, something else I meant to ask you right away. This can be on or off the record, but your wife mentioned something about the other woman, and I think she said her name was Lorraine. When I came to the gate...
Lorraine! Do you want a gossip sheet? Whew. I thought this was for Success Magazine. Well, this isn't for publication. Lorraine's my girlfriend, my mistress, if you will.
She's here?
Of course she's here.
He set up another log and then took off his jacket and rolled up the sleeves of his shirt.
Your wife doesn't mind you having a live-in girlfriend?
Off the record or on it? Well, write what you please. We don't care. No, she doesn't mind. She knows that a man like me needs more than one woman. That's how it happens to be. Always has been, from the start. We simply choose not to lie about it, not to indulge in the usual middling hypocrisies. I could tell you about men who have a different mistress every month. If you can afford it, you can do it. Everyone knows and nobody cares. So have you met Lorraine?
No.
Well, why don't you go back into the house and go back toward the other wing and introduce yourself to her and get her version of things and then come back and split some logs. Obviously, you need to get this girlfriend thing out of the way. Then we'll have a drink.
Millard pointed at the door. Walking down the hallways in a kind of trance, Krumholtz thought of his wife, Kathy. She'd be sitting the girls down about now for dinner. They'd be gathered under the kitchen light, maybe eating spaghetti together. Kathy made a great sauce. Her spaghetti sauce was one of her little glories. Krumholtz went through a brief shudder of longing for his wife and daughters and home. He'd never felt anything but love for Kathy from the moment he'd met her. He thought of asking someone in this infernal Olympian household for a telephone so he could call to check up on her, see how she was doing. Krumholtz turned another corner near an open door and saw a woman, the one who must certainly be the girlfriend, Lorraine, lying back on a fainting couch. She was reading a glossy magazine and glanced up when Krumholtz entered.
You must be that guy.
I'm that guy.
He examined her. Unlike the wife, she was not particularly beautiful. On her left cheek was a birthmark in the shape of a candle flame.
I'm the guy you asked about angels. You were at the intercom.
The guy from the magazine? You didn't answer my question.
No, I suppose not.
He pointed at her.
You're wearing pajamas. It's mid-afternoon. Been napping?
What did you say your name was?
Krumholtz. Jerry Krumholtz.
Jerry, do you think Jimmy looked okay? I'm worried about him. He hasn't been himself lately, and no one knows why.
He looked all right. What do you think could be bothering him?
Krumholtz got out his notebook.
Me? What do I think? It could be anything. He's restless. I think he's run out of worlds to conquer, and that makes him sick.
She tossed the glossy magazine onto the floor.
He's got everything. What would you do if you had everything?
What a preposterous question. Krumholtz took out his pen.
Doesn't the wife mind that you're here?
Here? In this room or here in this house? No. Oh, you mean my existence here on Earth taking up the sexual slack? Why would she mind? Maybe you don't understand the situation. Or maybe you don't understand about men like Jimmy. He's just bigger than other men. Everything about him is bigger and stronger than they are. Those herd men, all the little schmooze. So unimportant. He's just richer and smarter and more beautiful than they are. He's at the top of the pyramid. The rules for the little doofuses don't apply to him. Do you understand that? If you don't understand that, Krumholtz, you don't understand anything.
So this is the harem?
Because otherwise there's no point in you being here or doing this story. He loves both Ellie and me. He has more than enough love for both of us and the children and the previous wife and the previous children. He flies out to see them. He has a private jet. He's not like ordinary men, is what I'm saying. I satisfy some of his needs, and Ellie satisfies other needs, and that's how it is. And if it isn't bourgeois enough for you, that's too bad.
What needs do you satisfy?
What sort of question is that? Is this going into the article?
It might. We'll see.
She stood up and walked over toward him.
You don't get it, do you?
She leaned into him, reaching around his back, and in what Krumholtz could tell instantly was a cruel, practical joke, brought her face close to his and planted a long kiss on his lips with the slightest suggestion of tongue. The kiss constituted sheer mockery of his unimportance. She might as well have been kissing a lampshade.
If you only believed in angels, Mr. Krumholtz, you might be lifted up now and then out of your pathetic little life.
Lorraine had touched him gently on the cheek.
But, sadly, no.
From outside came the sound of a rifle shot.
No one knows how we live. And no one's going to.
Krumholtz found the door out to the back terrace where Millard had been chopping firewood. When he saw Millard now in the distance, Krumholtz could make out that the man was covered with blood. He was bent over something with a knife in his hand and was cutting it lengthwise.
A deer, damn it. Somehow it got in the property. You know, they eat everything. There must be a hole in the fencing. They can be very aggressive and destructive.
Millard had in his hand a 4-inch field knife and another tool Krumholtz didn't recognize.
Have you ever done this? Some hunters bleed the deer, they cut its throat, but that's ridiculous because after all, the heart isn't pumping, so you have to hang the damn thing with its head down so the blood drains out. Anyway, we don't do that. So what you do is you get the deer on its back. Maybe you know, you look like you might be a hunter.
Yes, I can see what you're doing.
Would this scene provide him with the opening of his article? A winner not afraid of blood.
After you've cut the diaphragm away, you get the knife up to cut the esophagus out. Once that's cut, maybe you could get us a flashlight. You pull the lungs and the heart out, but that's tricky because they're attached with peritoneum.
Krumholtz couldn't be sure that he was hearing James Millard properly.
Blood. Yes, blood.
The man's words weren't making any sense.
The flashlight, slipcase, the meat sauce, blood stop, the tenderloin.
The winner seemed to be slipping into a verbal salad, a garble of ejaculations and non sequiturs as he worked.
Ceiling, intestine, sausage, blood, wedding, drool.
Feeling lightheaded, Krumholtz backed away from Millard and let himself into the house. In what appeared to be a sitting room close to the central hallway, he deposited himself onto a coal black sofa. He felt tired and hungry. For a moment, he closed his eyes. When he opened them, both James and Ellie Millard were standing in front of him. Wearing a crisply ironed pair of black slacks and a thick wool sweater, James Millard was bending toward Krumholtz, a drink in his hand.
Scotch?
No, thanks. Not just yet.
His mind rejects it, but his hand accepts it. Will you have dinner with us?
I really should get back into town. It's time to go. I'll come back tomorrow.
You'll get lost.
He noticed that she was very exclamatory.
You'll never get back. Weeks later, searchers will find you. Oh, stay with us. Never go away.
Yes, ask us the questions you want to have the answers to, and maybe, just maybe, we'll answer them.
Krumholtz took a slug of the scotch.
All right. Here's my question.
He took out his digital recorder and pretended to turn it on.
Why do you get to be happy?
Why do we get to be happy? What an absurd question. But I'll tell you, we all worked for it, and there were some rewards. You know the saying, Geld macht frei? We worked for it. We worked very hard, long days and long nights. And then, of course, we're lucky.
Yes, and it's the luck I'm interested in. About that luck, the reason I asked is that other people, little people, work long days and long nights, very long days, days that go on for longer than 24 hours, days that go for weeks at a time.
He felt a sudden lift off.
That kind of day, you know, a working day that lasts for weeks.
Is there a question in there somewhere?
You take me, for example.
Krumholtz felt some crucial disconnection.
We, that is, my wife and I, have neighbors, and the two of us, we... Well, I was once a musician, and she wanted to be a social worker. And she was a social worker for a while before they cut the state and federal funding, which they never restored. And then, well, this thing happened to us. And this, what I'm about to tell you, this was about 18 months after we were married, and she became pregnant. And immediately, she had complications.
He took another swig of the scotch, emptying the glass.
For the last 4 months of the pregnancy, she was spotting, so they kept her in bed. But she got through it. The baby,
It was a breach, so they had to perform a cesarean, and they didn't give my wife, Kathy, enough anesthetic, so the whole procedure took a bad toll on her, and she was in terrible pain there for a while, but our son was born. Michael. And it seemed as if everything would be all right, and we would recover.
Both Millard and his wife were staring at Krumholtz, their attention fixed on him. Millard rose and took Krumholtz's glass, refilling it, and then returned it to him. Krumholtz couldn't stop himself. Where had this story come from? It wasn't untrue, exactly, even though it hadn't happened.
And Michael seemed to be all right for a while. He thrived, and by the time he reached his fifth birthday, we thought we were out of the woods. But then, and I wouldn't be telling you this if we weren't at the end of the day and I weren't tired out.
Oh, go right ahead. Disunburden yourself.
Thank you. He became sick. It began with coughing, and he lost his appetite, and he was pale, and he never had any energy. Well, we couldn't get a diagnosis from the pediatrician, and of course, it was understandable. Who knows how to look or where? We did one blood test after another. I mean, they did. They did one blood test after another, beyond what our insurance could pay for, those ghouls. Though I suppose I shouldn't say that. They mean well, those medical professionals. And each time we went in, my son would start crying before they had even taken the blood, which tore at my heart. How can you get used to the suffering of a child? I mean, you can't. You can't get used to it, or you shouldn't. There's nothing there in that situation you should ever accept. And Michael was bleeding from the nose all the time, and sometimes from his mouth, for no reason that we knew. And then finally we got a diagnosis.
What was it?
Chronic thrombocytopenic purpura.
Krumholtz had once written an article about the disease and knew something about it.
That's the medical name for it. And there's no cure and no treatment, and invariably it's fatal. So, well, we had a certain amount of time. There was this question we were facing. What should we do? What should we do with the time we had left with our little boy? Of course, we asked Michael what he wanted to do. We had to ask him what he wanted to do more than anything else in the world. He didn't want to go to any of those destination places. He said he wanted to sit by the window.
Krumholtz took another swig of the scotch.
Michael sat by the window, and he would narrate what he saw. There was one particular bird, a sparrow, that came by for the breadcrumbs that Michael put out on his windowsill. And then when Michael died, the sparrow came by waiting for him for the food he had put out there. The bird would hop on the sill and chirp. Then one night, we heard a terrible thump against Michael's window. The next morning, we found the sparrow on the lawn. It seemed to have flung itself against his window. When I bent down to pick it up, I discovered that its heart had stopped.
Well, he had his triumph. The winner's wife was in tears, and the winner was contemplating Krumholtz with a kind of baffled annoyance while he attempted to comfort his wife. The damn tears, against the riches of the world, they changed almost nothing. Nevertheless, Krumholtz felt a power surging through him. No one would dare move him from his comfortable position on the sofa. He took another swig. Oh, stop.
Oh, stop.
Ellie Millard said, touching a hanky to her face. But he wasn't finished. Krumholtz could go on all night. They would have to shoot him to get rid of him. He didn't intend to budge. He would sit there with his audience in front of him, elaborating this story of suffering and pity and terror for as long as he pleased. He had just gotten started.
The winner appears in Minnesota writer Charles Baxter's latest book, Griffin, New in Selected Stories. We had to shorten the piece in adapting it for the radio, but you can read the full version on our website, mprnews.org. Thanks to actors Michael Booth, Charles Fraser, Leah Horton, Tina Mae Gallivan, and Patrick Coyle. I'm Annie Baxter, and this is Writing Minnesota, a special program featuring writers from around the state.
If you were listening earlier, you heard Charles Baxter say he often writes characters who keep secrets. Well, poet Matt Rasmussen brings us to his secret world inside his refrigerator in Robbinsdale.
This poem is titled Land O' Lakes. A tinfoil lake rattles the sun as a canoe crosses it, approaching my shore. The Native American girl walks toward me, kneels, offers a golden box of butter. And then she's on the box I am holding. Apparently, I've accepted. Come, she says. We will burn beauty into something even more beautiful. It is evening inside the refrigerator. I lie down shivering near the lake. The giant red ring hovers behind her, generating warmth. You must fall asleep in your dream to wake up in your life, she says. I can hear the vegetables dying in the crisper, and through the door, the television weeping openly, unashamed.
Poet Matt Rasmussen in Robbinsdale. His poem Land O' Lakes appears in his chapbook, Finger Gun. We've been hearing poems and stories this hour that reflect what life is like in Minnesota, and we're also hearing about what it means to be a writer here. For poet Philip Bryant, you can't broach that topic without a trip to Stearns County. That's where I met up with him a couple months ago, back when the state was knee-deep in winter. We were going to a poetry reading in an unusual place, and Bryant led me on a trek through a snowy woods to get there.
This is kind of packed now.
Whoa, it's getting deep now.
Yeah.
This area has special meaning for Bryant. It's where his wife's family is from, and it's the place where he came into his own as a poet after struggling with his craft for years. Bryant grew up on Chicago's South Side in a household filled with jazz music. His dad owned as many as 8,000 jazz albums. Jazz, blues, and the black culture of the South Side gave Bryant a deep well of stories and images to draw from in his writing. But he could only tap that material once he transplanted himself to rural Minnesota, a place that couldn't be more different from home.
It's a weird thing. I mean, it's hard to really say, well, why that is. And why would, you know, a little black boy from the South Side of Chicago, all of his material is there, come here, and all of a sudden that material be suddenly present for him.
We walk on through the woods. Overhead, the sky is a dreamy kind of blue. Bryant says the serenity of this landscape helped bring his poetry forth.
I mean, I would think about writing stuff in Chicago all the time, but never had the space to really, you know, actuate that. And here in Minnesota, I've had that space.
Turns out it doesn't take much physical space. Our destination for the poetry reading is a little shack out on the ice.
18's welcome.
The ice house belongs to Brother Paul Jasmer. He's a monk at St. John's Abbey. Brother Paul likes having people by to drink tea and read poetry.
Poem up on the wall there.
Oh my God.
Do you have any kind of protocol for how this happens?
No incantations. Just open the book and start reading. And
for years, Philip Bryant has been stopping by to read his poems to Brother Paul. The one he reads today shares its name with an old jazz standard. It's called Stella by Starlight.
My mother couldn't understand how my father, a man stuffed so full of promise and potential, could wither it all away on a stack of bebop records and a bottle of beer. And his close friend Preston was worse, undereducated, and couldn't speak the king's English if you held a gun to his head, gave him the book, and asked him to quote any passage out of Shakespeare. Why my father associated with him, who in my mother's opinion was far beneath him, was an open mystery, something beyond her. Jazz, 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 that's all she heard, morning, noon, and night. When he could have easily risen to be a great surgeon, lawyer, or civil rights leader. But one day, I walked in on them by accident, and there they were. Preston and my dad, a little drunk, crouched over the turntable. I understood why when they turned around, taken completely by surprise for an instant. I saw that both their dark faces reflected the light and were shining.
Most of Bryant's poems are about his life growing up in Chicago. But he's lived here now for more than 20 years, so Minnesota shows up from time to time, too. He says a few years ago, someone even called him a Minnesota writer.
And on the one hand, I was very proud, but then sad in the other sense, too, because it's sort of like, does that mean I'm not a Chicago writer? I'm going to be in two places at once most of the time.
Philip Bryant teaches at Gustavus Adolphus College and is author of three books of poetry. You can hear him read one of his poems set in Minnesota, a very funny one, on our website, mprnews.org. So, shall we head to St. Paul for dessert? I know a place that makes a mean cake. It comes with our final poem.
I'm Katrina Vandenberg, and this poem is called Consuming Desire. I'm not making this up. In Café Latte's wine bar, one of the lovely co-eds at the next table touched John on the arm as if I wasn't there and said,
"Excuse me, sir."
"Excuse me, sir."
"But what is that naughty little dessert?"
"But what's that naughty little dessert?" And I knew from the way he glanced at the frothy neckline of her blouse, then immediately cast his eyes on his plate before giving a fatherly answer. He would have given up dessert 3 months for the chance to feed this one to her. I was stunned. John was hopeful, but the girl was hitting on his cake. Though she told her friend until they left, she did not want any. I wish she wanted something. My husband, his cake, both at once. I wish she left insisting upon the beauty of his hands, his curls, the sublimeness of strawberries and angel food. But she was precocious, and I fear adulthood is the discipline of being above desire, cultivated after years of learning what you want and where and how, after insisting that you will one day have it. I don't ever want to stop noticing a man like the one at the bar in his loosened tie, reading the Star Tribune. I don't want to eat my cake with a baby spoon to force small bites, as women's magazines suggest. And you don't want to either, do you? You want a big piece of this world. You would love to have the whole thing.
That's poet Katrina Vandenberg in St. Paul. She's the author of two books of poetry. That's it for our special program, Writing Minnesota. I hope our show has given you a taste of some of the many talents living right in our backyard, and maybe a new perspective on what it's like to live in our state. But you know, I think all the writing we featured in the show tells us something bigger about ourselves, too. Something that's not bound by narrow geographies. The Southern writer Eudora Welty phrased it best. She said, "One place understood helps us understand all places better." Our show was produced by Curtis Gilbert and me, with help from Chris Roberts, Johnny Vince Evans, and editor Mike Edgerly. Many thanks to the Loft Literary Center, our partner in the production. Writing Minnesota is supported in part by the Minnesota Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. You can download the show and read many of the literary works featured here today, as well as some special web-only extras at our website, mprnews.org. I'm Annie Baxter. Thanks for listening, and happy reading!